Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. You want to hear a horrible term? I've always hated this term when it comes to medicine. I don't know. It's always made my skin crawl. It's actually the word rhinoplasty. A rhino, of course, referring to a rhinoceros and the idea that they've got the big horn, you know, sticking out of their nose. Plasty goes to a surgical intervention, perhaps, that is going to alter one's appearance, rhinoplasty. We might otherwise know it as a nose job. And there are many people who have had nose jobs because of serious cosmetic issues, and they look so much better. And at the end of the day, you know, it all depends on your own personal perception of yourself. Maybe it needs to have a medical intervention that requires rhinoplasty. And then there's others, I think, that we can go back in time and look that have had rhinoplasty and probably ill-advised. today's case is a case that involves an individual who, according to her, administered a nose job. Only this was not a surgical intervention. This was murder. And the instrument was a .380 caliber pistol. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Brother Dave, I'm going to tell you something about myself today that I have never told you.
Uh-oh.
I know, right? Hold on. Friends, in case you don't know it, Dave and I are actually, we do our tapings actually looking at one another. We can see one another, you know. Yeah.
Scary sometimes. Like
we're having a conversation. It is scary. Mm-hmm. It is scary. We see ourselves in all sorts of dishevelment, and other days we'll come in and say, hey, what'd you do? Take a shower today? But Dave, do you know I've broken my nose 4 times in my life?
Really?
Actually, 3.
On purpose?
And I no. But the first time I fell at a skating rink and my face was used to catch myself. First time I'd been on skates. I think I was probably 8.
Wow.
Terrifying. The other one, I actually had a dear friend of mine. I was at a church, the church we attended when I was a kid. I was coming out of what we call the game room. This church is really old, so every door in the church was solid oak. And she had come running down the hallway as I was walking out the door, grabbed the solid oak door, and slammed it on my face. I never saw it coming.
Wow.
And that broke my nose. And then I broke my nose in football. I actually had a face mask that gave way and caved in on me. Took a shot to the face. And then the other one I think might have been a broken nose, I'm not going to go into. But suffice it to say, I have now rather a robust proboscis, as
Jimmy Durante.
But yeah, Jimmy Durante. You know, I've got a big ridge in my nose. You know, it my nose generally arrives at a location a couple of seconds ahead of the rest of me. So I'll put it to you that way. If it were raining outside, people could take shelter in my nose to stay dry. So
I never noticed your nose being large.
Well, it is rather robust, but that's okay. There are many people that do go under the knife, if you will, for rhinoplasty. One of the things that's always kind of put me off about the process is that hammers and chisels are used many times. Now, there's surgical hammers and chisels, you know, to knock off edges and whatnot. There's something kind of ghastly about it. you know, we do ghastly things in the morgue, obviously, but, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, the breaking, you know, in order, you know, what's the old adage? You got to break some eggs to make an omelet.
Yeah.
You got to break the nose. And that's why you see this, the bilateral raccoon eyes with people that have undergone rhinoplasty, because you're fracturing the skull.
Wow. Is it true that your nose, once you have a nose job, that your nose doesn't keep growing? I know when we get older, our nose and our ears continue to grow, correct?
The soft tissue does.
Okay.
Okay.
When you have
the underlying skeletal structure.
Okay. But when you have a nose job, does that prevent your nose from getting longer as you age?
I'm going to tell you. Right now, I'm going to say it plainly. I have no idea. I don't have an answer to that question. But I can tell you this. I would think that it would disrupt it to a certain degree. Here's a kind of a little bony fact, if you will. Did you know that in your throughout your skeleton, you have what are referred to, medical types refer to it and anatomists refer to it as foramen. Now, foramen are these tiny little holes that are in bone, okay?
All right.
As a matter of fact, the largest foramen that we have is what's referred to as the foramen magnum, and it is at the base of the skull. It's the biggest bony hole in your body, and it's where your spinal cord emerges, comes out of that hole, you know, from beneath the brain, and you've got tiny little foramen that surround it, and that's where blood vessels pass through, Dave. So if you've got like a foramen in your, you know, your facial structure that is a blood supply to the soft tissues around and to the bone too, if you get it altered surgically, I really wonder how surgeons go in and account for that, because those vessels have to go somewhere else, or does it diminish the supply of blood? And I know that there's people out there that are surgeons and work with surgeons, and they could probably have the answer to that. But it is interesting, to say the very least. And you have to account for that in, you know, people that want to improve their appearance
or alter.
you know, they pursue these types of things. And that's kind of at the heart, at the center, I think, at least a comment that's associated with this case.
It is referred to as the nose job murder.
Yeah, it is. And look, all aside, I've covered this case. I've covered it in the news. I've covered it with Nancy. I think I covered it probably on Law and Crime Network. Mm-hmm. When they were still doing the daily court coverage, and, you know, I would be one of the, it's almost like being a color commentator. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a strange thing. I'm almost sure that, and we're talking about the Shayna Huber's case. And you had questions for me about this case, and I was like, okay, well, I'll revisit this with you because you've got questions. I want to try to answer them best I can.
You know, Joe, it is called the nose job murder because Shayna Hubers claims she shot her boyfriend in self-defense. And during her interview with police, she said that he was very vain and that she had a friend who was a dentist, and Ryan Poston, the victim here, wanted to get veneers for his teeth, and he also wanted to get a nose job. And in this interview with police, after Ryan Poston has been shot 6 times in the face, Shayna Huber says, "I gave him the nose job he always wanted." That's why this case has been called the nose job murder, because who would say that about somebody they claim to love?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And I use the term chilling a lot. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond chilling. This has got a level of disgusting to it, I think. And I think that it's important that we remember the victim, Ryan Poston here, and what he did for a living, Dave. I mean, he was an attorney, okay? Most people think of attorneys in the criminal sense where you're in trial and you're in this big courtroom and you're presenting to the jury, and that's very typical. You know, you can practice law in any number of ways. Contract law, you'll never walk inside of a courtroom, you know, to try a case. That's, you know, that's not what they do. But for him, I think, Dave, first off, he's a good looking cat. I can say that, you know, to begin with, handsome, had a lot of friends that really loved him and thought he was a really cool dude. He had gone to, I think he went to the University of Indiana or Indiana University, undergraduate, was a triple major there. An eye toward going to law school. And I think that he wound up going to the University of Northern Kentucky for his law degree.
I'm just trying to think, a triple major. Do you know the brain power that requires?
Yeah, you got to stay on top of it.
That's beyond me.
Yeah, it's like a normal degree is like, I think at Jack State, it's 100, you know, average. It's going to vary, but it's like 120 hours.
Right.
All right, roughly 120, 24 hours. That's for an undergraduate degree. Well, you still have to do all of the major requisites for, if you're majoring in political science, which I think he was, geography, which I think he was, and I can't remember what the other one was, but there were like three. He might walk out of the door with 165 undergraduate hours. And you say, well, what would be the point? Well, he's trying to be well-rounded, I think, you know, before he sets himself up to go to law school, be able to write effectively and do all those things. And he was apparently quite the success, Dave.
He was out of Cincinnati where he practiced. And, you know, you mentioned a minute ago about his friends really caring about him. Ryan Poston was a well thought of individual at 29 years old, a very accomplished young man. And he kind of had his pick of the women he would see. You know, he was obviously smart, obviously attractive, and, you know, a good guy. Here's the problem. He and Shayna Hubers dated for 18 months, and it was an on-again, off-again relationship. I've pored over some text messages between the two of them, and it's interesting if you realize that, first of all, Shayna was 21 years old, and she was in college at the time. No slouch intellectually. But, you know, you have people that are street smart, and yet they lack in other areas of maturity or, you know, street smarts and things like that. And she was lacking in social graces and being able to be somebody that people would really like. She had a lot of edges on her. Again, very smart and very attractive, but there were parts of her that were really unappealing to people who got to know her. And in this case with Ryan, they dated 18 months. They met online, as many people do these days. Ryan actually saw a Facebook picture that she posted of a spring break trip she had. He liked the photo. That led to communication online. They met. They went out. And it was a hot relationship at times. There was a lot of intensity there. And here's the part about Ryan that I think his friends were, I'm glad they shared it with us. He didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. He really was that guy. He didn't want, you know, some people just, they don't care about others' feelings. They don't, and they just go through life like that. Ryan did. He cared so much about other people's feelings. In particular, with Shayna, he wanted to break up with her. He needed to break up with her, but he didn't want to hurt her feelings. So he would do it in soft ways, not very direct and not final, and always left this door open, and she would come back. She was relentless. And
yeah, the number of text messages, I think, is something that really, and this is, we have to go back. This case originated in 2012, I think it was. Yeah. I look back in time, interestingly enough, I got to say, guess what else was in the news at this particular time that kind of parallels this case, and something Shayna Hubers actually referenced, and that's the Jodi Arias trial.
Yeah.
This was actually, the trial itself was going on during this period of time. I know because, I'd been, I was at HLN at the time, you know, covering this thing with Vinny and the guys. And we covered it for a long, long time. And it's striking parallels, you know, in this case and with Jodi Arias. I don't know, can you say unrequited love, or, you know, wanting to distance yourself from someone? You've got this highly charged relationship that's, you know, you've got these people that are deeply, intimately involved. I was listening to an interview regarding this case, and a lady that was speaking, I believe she was one of the former prosecutors, had said that this victim, Ryan, would come home, Dave, and somehow Shayna would get into his apartment, and he would walk through the door, and she would be lying on the sofa nude, smiling at him when he walked in. Now, look, I'm a red-blooded man. I'm not saying that I have an aversion to that when it comes to my wife. However, I have to say, you've got someone that has come into your space and feels that very comfortable in an intimate setting, that very bold like that, and you know that they don't necessarily want you any longer, and you're going to literally bare yourself to them. You're really in a very, very difficult area. It's an emotionally charged situation, and it can only get worse, Dave.
During the time of their relationship, Ryan would text Shayna, "It's over." As you think about how bold it would take for somebody to be to, you know, sneak into the house, break into the house, and be laying there on the couch nude when the man comes home. Shayna was aggressive and relentless when it came to Ryan Poston. She was there constantly, even when he said, "Stop, please stop." But Joe, one thing I did notice, I'm going to share, February 2012, he sends her a text. "You can tell people you broke up with me." He's negotiating here. You know, she won't stop. She won't leave him alone. "Look, tell people you broke up with me. That I'm good with that." March of 2012, the next month, Ryan to Shayna, "Stop texting me." April, "I no longer have the patience to deal with you." So 3 months in a row, he is sending very specific things to Shayna, but she won't give up. Relentless. Investigators found hundreds of thousands of text messages between Ryan and Shayna. And again, remember, their relationship only lasted a period of 18 months. For every one message that Ryan sent to Shayna, Shayna probably sent 50 to him.
Wow, what a ratio.
She could not stop herself. And when it came right down to it, Ryan had been chased out of his own house and it ended up at his stepfather's house in the middle of the night because she wouldn't leave his place. She would not leave. He had to leave his own condo because she wouldn't leave. He wanted to get physical with her. Now, she claimed he was, Joe. She claimed he was physically abusive to her. As a matter of fact, she showed bruises on her arms to a next-door neighbor, claiming that Ryan did that. She confessed later on that she bruised herself. Now, I'm no lawyer. You're no lawyer. But we hang out with a lot of lawyers.
Yes, we do.
What does that seem like to you, Joe, that she was playing a long game to get him back after he had said, "Stop, leave me alone," and she wouldn't, that now she's turned the tables and now she's planning something else maybe?
Yeah, and I think that many people would, in a knee-jerk manner, probably say that she's simply crazy and dismiss it. But let me tell you this. Just because somebody actually behaves in a manner in which you see as quote unquote crazy does not necessarily mean that they're insane. However, what it might mean is that they are pure evil. who actually makes a comment that is so callous when speaking of the dead. And again, I want to, as you know, as an advocate for the dead here, I got to say, the dead can't offer up any testimony on their own behalf. We need to keep that in mind. But what kind of person and what context was this comment about nose jobs made, Dave?
Well, on the night in question, October the 12th, 2012, Shanna Hubers is at Ryan Poston's house. They spent October the 11th together and had actually gone to Shanna's mother's house. Ryan was trying to ease her out of the relationship. He told Shanna, "I have a date tomorrow night on the 12th at 9:30 p.m. I have a date." By the way, his date was with the reigning Miss Ohio USA. Her name is Audrey Bolt. He has a date, and he's telling her this. Now, he's trying to be nice to Shayna so that he can leave with class. But they go to Shayna's mama's house on October 11th, October 12th, or October the 11th. She spends the night. She will not leave Ryan's house. After everything he's trying to do, she still won't leave. So on October the 12th, he's telling her, "I have a date. I'm going out. You need to leave." And she won't. On October the 12th, 911 gets a call. Emergency medical services called to the scene because Shanna Hubers says, "I shot my boyfriend in self-defense." That's the case. "I shot my boyfriend in self-defense" in this 911 call. It's hours later when she's being interviewed by police and she explains the shooting and, by the way, six shots in all. And she says to the investigator, a female investigator, she's sitting in the room and Shanna Hubers says he's vain. He wanted veneers and he wanted a nose job. "So I gave him the nose job he always wanted by shooting him in the face, Joe." That's where the nose job murder comes from. "I shot him in the face and I gave him the nose job he always wanted."
Wow. You know, it's not too often. I think a lot of people, forgive me, Dave. I'm always referring to things that we see in Hollywood, things we see in movies, as kind of a point of reference, but I feel as though I'm compelled to do that because they get so much wrong. And, you know, from a forensics perspective, how right. We handle cases and probability and all those sorts of things. First off, headshots are very difficult to score.
Really?
When you think about it, yes, they are. Yeah. You know, when you're firing, it's a smaller object. You know, if mm-hmm. you're in the military, if you worked in law enforcement, or if you just you enjoy weapons and you go out training and you have an instructor, the one thing they're always going to tell you, particularly when you're thinking about firing from the perspective of an aggressor coming at you, you always fire for center mass. Okay. Center mass means that, you know, essentially if you think about from the shoulders to the abdomen, okay, well, that's a much bigger target than the head, right? So it's Hollywood loves to deal in fantasy, okay, and it's fantastical many times to think, well, they scored a headshot from a great distance. I love these movies that show someone firing a pistol, and it's from yards and yards and yards away, and right. They score, you know, a center mass. I mean, they score a headshot mm-hmm. as opposed to firing at center mass to knock the person down. Those are the exceptions, not the rules. Okay. However, if you do score a headshot, the first thing as far as range of fire goes that I like to think of is that I think about proximity, because most of the time when you fire a weapon, it's different firing at static targets. You know, if you've got a paper target that's hanging up, or if you're shooting, you know, I don't know, old coffee cans off of a fence post, which my grandfather used to do, taught me how to shoot that way with a BB gun, actually. That's completely different than working in a dynamic environment where you have an individual advancing on you. You know, say you've got this woman who is being abused and she feels threatened and she shoots. Do you want to hear literally right now? I want to tell you about this. One of the most fantastic, I say fantastic, one of the most unbelievable shots that I have ever borne witness to as an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And again, now this is a true case of domestic abuse. There was a case that I worked many, many years ago, immediately adjacent to the New Orleans International Airport. And there was a trailer park underneath an overpass, if you can imagine that. So you're living beneath an underpass, an overpass, in trailers immediately adjacent to the airport, which is an international airport, and it's busy. So you've got the sound of traffic over you, and you've also got the sound of jets taking off and landing there at Louis Armstrong Airport. Dave, there was this man and a woman that lived together in this trailer, and the trailer itself had a set of concrete steps that you would push up to the side, you know, prefab steps. That was a single entrance into it that actually had steps. And they had a screen door on the trailer, and they would leave the primary interior door open. Well, he had beaten this poor woman over and over again. He'd get hammered drunk. He'd raise his hand to her. And then he would have these, you know, bold things that he would get out in the yard and start screaming at the trailer at her, you know, calling her names and just continuing to just act like a wild man after he beat her. They'd had the police that had rolled out there a couple of times. The locals that lived there, they saw it happen. You know, they saw him demonstrating out there outside of the trailer, you know, I guess like marking his territory or something after he would hit this poor woman. Well, he did it one too many times, Dave. And this comes down to the idea of the most incredible shot that I've ever seen. According to witnesses, now I saw the aftermath, okay, but according to witnesses, they heard arguing going on, or they heard him screaming. He had walked out of the house off those concrete steps. The screen door was closed behind him. And he said something to her to the effect, I'm going to come back in there and beat your ass again. And he had said that, and he's screaming this, and he's screaming it over and over again. And this poor, and she was a little bitty, tiny thing. She retrieves a 25 caliber pistol, which is one of the smallest caliber handguns you can have. Some people refer to it as a pocket pistol or a belly gun. He is at the base of these stairs, Dave, and he's yelling at her. And somebody says, they heard him say, you've got the gun. Go ahead. I'm a man. I can take it. And he made that pronouncement one more time. I'm a man. I can take, and it cut off and it was replaced with a sound of pop. Dave, she shot this guy through an intermediate target, which is the screen door, on a downward trajectory. And Dave, here comes the big finish. His mouth was open. He was in mid-sentence. That round passed through his open mouth and actually lodged in the base of his brain, at the stem, at the stem of the spinal cord there, at the brain stem rather, and dropped him immediately to his knees. Now, that goes to range of fire and proximity. How do you score it? Well, that was a one in a million shot through a screen door, into an open mouth and lodging in the brainstem. When we look at this Huber's case involving, you know, Ron Potson, these shots that were fired, and I think Dave, correct me if I'm wrong. How many were there?
Six.
Six. Yeah,
there were two right away. Yeah, witnesses. Two quick shots, and then quiet for enough time to be noted by the ear witnesses next door, and then a succession of four more shots. So bam, 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 bam.
And it was a .380 pistol,
mm-hmm,
that she had. And that is like, in when we think about these belly guns, as I mentioned, mm-hmm, just a second ago, pocket pistols, you've got you've got three. There used to be four, and you can still find the fourth caliber, but it's rare. 22 caliber, okay? 22 caliber pistol, and this is, you can hold it in the palm of your hand and people wouldn't know that you have it. A 25 caliber, the aforementioned caliber I was referring to with this miraculous shot, and then 380. The 380 is .380 caliber. It's just like a 38 special, but it's not the 380. The 380 caliber is not as robust as a 38 special, which cops used to carry. The diameter of the projectile is the same. Okay. But the robustness, the length, the weight of the projectile of a 380 versus a 38 special is not as robust as a 38 special, but you'll see people that want to have a concealed weapon on them carry these things. And Dave, you have to be in close proximity for these things to be effective. Okay. Now you can score a shot from a distance, but with those smaller calibers like that at a greater distance, it's as much luck as it is skill. So this tells me about this case that you had to have very close proximity when this weapon was being fired. And here's another bit about this. The assessment of Ryan's injuries indicated that he had stippling on his face, all about, as a matter of fact, associated with these rounds. And I got to tell you, for those that don't know, those bits of evidence that are left behind by unburnt gunpowder, for instance, will always tell the tale. Ballistic fingerprints. I think that's a term that is thrown around frequently, and it's kind of broad ranging, dependent upon how it's being applied. Because you have markings on bullets, you have things that are kind of left behind by projectiles, and even by weapons themselves that we'd look at that are going to paint the picture when a firearm is involved. Dave,
now I've got questions about multiple things here, Joe. So, one, Shannon Hubers from the very beginning claimed it was self-defense. And we also know that before she called 911, she called her mother. All right. Yikes. So, yeah. Now, I want to get back to the shooting. You said stippling on our victim here. Ryan had stippling. We know there were six shots. We know that, yeah, Shannon Hubers claims that he was standing coming towards her. The story is that he pulled a gun on her, that he had been beating her all day like a rag doll, throwing her around, and that he pulled a gun, and she, fearing for her life, grabbed a gun and shot him six times in the face. And that's her story, and she's sticking to it. So if he's standing and she shoots him only because he's coming at her and she fears for her life, I'm going to assume, and I want you to correct me, that there's going to be indications of that based on blood on him and surrounding areas. Prosecution claims he was not standing. They claim he was sitting. Yeah. I've got to assume here that we've got a lot of differences between somebody standing being shot in the head and sitting being shot in the head. And you just said stippling. So,
yeah.
There's a whole lot to unpack here, Joe.
Yeah, there are. And let me kind of lay this out to you. When we say stippling, relative to our findings in forensic pathology, and stippling will be, you look at the skin, and bits of unburned gunpowder will actually be with great force slam into the skin, and it kind of buries itself there. And what it looks like, okay, this is what it looks like. Just imagine, if you will, you had a handful of black pepper, okay, and you just kind of take it and slap it onto a particular surface. You're not kind of tossing it out. you know, like shaking it out of a shaker. You've got a handful of it, okay? And you lay it down on a surface. And you'll see, if you did that, you would see it kind of concentrated in a particular area. And as it begins to extend out from the center, it becomes more widely dispersed, all right? That's kind of what stippling looks like. Most of the time, you'll have a defect, which is just a fancy term that forensic pathologists use for hole, all right? So when you're talking about firearms-related deaths, so you got the hole that's generated by the projectile, and that's called a defect. And then extending out from it, you'll have these little bitty dots that look like black pepper. Well, those dots are stippling. That's unburned propellant or gunpowder that comes out of the end of the muzzle when the weapon is discharged. So you think that everything is burned up because, you know, it's like when you fire a bullet. I was actually just teaching this the other day in my intro forensics class. When you fire a bullet, okay, a live round, it's almost like launching a rocket. You have a primer cap in the bottom, okay, that's got it's less stable than gunpowder itself, the primer, because what you want to do is you tap it. It's actually a cap that's below there. It sends a spark through the flash holes in the base of the projectile. The powder is seated on top of the flash holes, and the powder ignites, and it drives out the projectile. And so just because this thing ignites and it burns off and you hear the loud pop that comes along with a weapon being fired doesn't mean that all that powder is consumed by the fire. Some of it just gets blown out through the explosion. And it's not what an engineer would call efficient. You know, so people want to have propellant or the gunpowder. They want to have it to the point chemically where you're going to get literally the most bang for your buck. Sometimes it just doesn't totally ignite. That powder's driven out of the end of the barrel, and it's got to go somewhere. Here's the trick, though, Dave. Powder, if you think about talcum powder, for instance, and you just put it in your hand, you blew it out, what's it going to do? Well, after a few feet, the blown air that comes out from between your lips is going to be insufficient to drive that powder any further downrange away from the palm of your hand that you've blown it out of. It's going to drift down to the earth, okay? Gravity's going to take over and pull it down. Well, just like that, gunpowder is not very aerodynamic, okay? It bleeds off that energy really quick. And after that initial blast, it drifts away. So once you get outside, I think, in my opinion, particularly with a 380, once you get outside of about 18 to 25 inches with this particular caliber, there won't be any evidence of it, more than likely. You might have a bit of it kind of float down and whatnot, but that kind of concentrated blast that you get that's going to lead to it actually blasting into the skin. So for us, when we're talking about this and we're trying to determine range of fire, we're going to look at the distribution pattern of the stippling. So the further out it is that it extends from that little central hole that the bullet has made or projectile has made, the greater the distance, because it spreads out almost like if you're firing like birdshot out of a shotgun, it kind of spreads. Well, same principle, it spreads, and the further out it spreads, you know that the individual firing the weapon was further away. So the tighter the concentration, the closer it is.
Okay, so you can tell by these shots whether or not Ryan was standing or sitting.
Yes.
Whether he was charging forward. Mm. What did the blood tell you? Because I know that they actually discussed where the blood was on his shirt and undershirt, and his, I guess he was wearing sweatpants, where the blood was from him, because Shayna Hubers was not bleeding. And by the way, her claiming that she had been slung around that condo like a rag doll and all that, when police got to the scene, that's not what they described seeing.
What did I tell you? I think it was just a couple episodes ago. We had the same discussion about what's our canned line. Let's see if you remember it. We go to the scene and are there any, what is it? What do we say? Were there any signs of
Joe, I'm a nut. I can't figure it out.
And I'll give it to you. Any signs of forced entry or struggle?
Thank you.
That's kind of our, that's ground zero for what we do. Right. And if I've got a victim saying, he has been beating my tail all day. As a matter of fact, she goes into great detail. He has been throwing me around like a rag doll.
Okay, slung me into the TV.
Yeah. And guess what? TV's still functioning.
With okay? dust on it. It's got dust on it. His dad, I mean, family members said he was kind of a slob. Okay. They're not being mean to say that. It's just, hey, he was kind of a slob.
A slob.
And that's the fact that they pointed out on the TV. She specifically said he slung me into the TV. And when they looked at the TV, there was dust on it.
And that's something that we would notice very quickly because I've actually, I don't know if I've ever had a television. I have had a door though, where individual claimed that they'd been thrown into and there was a dusty, it was covered with dust. And I've seen a point of impact in dust, and you can almost make out an outline on the door where you can see like the lateral, like the right lateral side impacts. I've seen this on cars, Dave, dusty cars that people are hit by. I saw a guy that was almost bent like a pretzel that the impact was like in his hip of the bumper, but he bent to the point where you could see his arm catching himself on the hood of the car. I actually had it happen on a MARTA train one time. I had a guy that committed suicide by throwing himself in the main, what's called Little Five, or it's called actually Five Points, Little Five Points, another location in Atlanta, but in the Five Points area, which is the main hub where you get onto the MARTA trains. And you could see his arm, the outline of his arm where it hit the dust. And you could see his fingers even extended when he was impacted by that train. So that kind of disturbance or lack thereof is going to tell us a lot. If you're telling me that you've been slammed around this apartment, I'm not just going to look for disturbed dust on a television. I'm going to look for, you know, any kind of knickknack that has been busted or broken. And there's a big difference. Listen, I don't know about you, but I am a slob. I am a slob. I freely admit it. I'm part of the slob kingdom.
Right.
So for me in this environment, I can walk into a hoarder's home, which I've walked into a lot of these homes where people have died, and I can tell what was naturally, that makes it sound like nature had a hand. But what items have been placed in a location and have been there for a protracted period of time, as opposed to somebody being in an environment where a tussle has taken place, or maybe they've fallen over and knocked something over. It just looks different. It looks different than sloppiness. And so I think that's, you know, you're right. You know, that's what his dad was saying about this, that, yeah, my son's a slob. That's okay. You know, he is a slob, but there's a big difference between being a slob and having, you know, a busted TV or maybe broken furniture or anything like that.
And that was their point, is that, okay, he's a slob, fine, but there's no indication that a violent struggle happened in this condo. And this is all in the first minutes of the investigation, where they see the scene. You've got the 29-year-old dead, and she's claiming he was standing, charging towards her when she shot him. The physical evidence does not show that. The prosecution claims he was sitting at the table, Joe, at the dining room table, sitting at the table in a chair when he was shot. How are you going to prove that? I mean, you talked about the stippling, so I understand being close. But what about the blood on the shirt and on the sweatpants?
Let me tell you what's going to happen when, you know, I was talking about rhinoplasty earlier and kind of the tools that they utilize. One of the things you find out with the head, human head, it's very vascular, probably... out of all of the regions of the body, you've got more vessels that pass for the size, relative size of the head, more vessels that pass through it than any other location of the body. It's because the brain demands so much blood. Okay. So when you're slammed in the face with a projectile, one of the things that's going to happen, are multiple little fractures all over the place. When an individual essentially takes their own life with a weapon, whether it be to the side of the head or in the mouth, you're fracturing the floor of the skull essentially, and all of the associated support structures, facial structures, and they have so many vessels that pour, that run through them. That's why you'll see like a tremendous amount of blood that issues forth from the body almost immediately. And if you are in a seated position, okay, so we're, you and I are sitting across a table from one another. If we're in a seated position and a projectile hits you center mass in the face, say right in the nose, for lack of a better, anatomic position, blood is going to almost immediately begin to gush out of your nose and your mouth. I've seen this happen both ways. Well, where does it wind up? Well, obviously it's going to get on the front of your shirt. If you're seated, it's going to wind up staining your lap. But here's the thing. When you get the body in a position where you can examine it and say you've extended the legs, like on an examining table, and you're looking at the clothing, did you know that you will see a big blood stain on the lap, then probably on the upper chest, maybe running down in the abdomen? But when the legs are extended, you'll see a big gap in the waist between where the blood starts on the tops of the thighs and where it ends at, say, the abdomen. You'll, when you spread the body out, you'll see a gap. And that gives you an indication that perhaps a person was in a seated position. Now, you have to couple that when you begin to talk about her relationship relative, and I'm talking about physical dynamic crime scene relationship. We're not talking about Dr. Phil here, where you're, you also have to factor in trajectory, because it's not just his position, it's her position as well. So if you look at, if you look at where positionality relative to the end of the muzzle, was she firing from above to below? And remember, when you read a lot of these autopsy reports involving, and you and I certainly have, you begin to describe these injuries, the physician will always talk about it's left to right, front to back, and either from below to above or from above to below. That gives us, that's a three-dimensional portrait that you're painting there relative to trajectory. And that's important as well. So it's not just the range of fire, it's also their trajectory. But I got to tell you, I want to conclude by saying this, a quote directly from my good friend, Nancy Grace. And hopefully she won't come down too hard on me for, you know, borrowing this, but she always says, if you want to know the horse, check its track record. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bag.